It's Tuesday again, and I would like to hang with you lads, but I'm off to listen to the new episode of the Slaving Selection Show. Play now or stay in dark forever.
As I have said, this time I changed my studio, and it's not as good as the other one, but now it's too late. The walls are too thin, and the employees are keep running around banging the doors. Well, what are you gonna do? So, before I start, thanks again to Immacity Leeds for the digital marketing support and Coma Studio for the soundtrack. I bit my lip the other day, so even my voice is not the greatest. Okay, enough of excuses for this week. Yeah, so I'm on the Patreon now. Now, not that I'm expecting anything anytime soon, but it's something I will need this way or another, so, you know, I might as well do it now. So, the day I was writing this episode was the 24th. It was Palm Sunday. And Palm Sunday in 1812 was on the 26th. It's today when I'm recording this. And that day, Caracas was struck with a devastating earthquake. It was 18 years before Venezuela was a fully independent country. I think it was still Colombia at that time. The city has a history of seismic activities, like with various earthquakes recorded since 1950, including events like the 2010 earthquake in Carupano with a magnitude of 5.6, and then the devastating 1812 earthquake in Caracas and Vargas with a magnitude of 7.7 on the moment magnitude scale, causing extreme damage and resulting in, believe it or not, 15 to 20,000 casualties. Earthquakes occur relatively frequently in Caracas. On average, there are about 95 earthquakes per year in the region, which translates to approximately, I would say, one earthquake every 4 days. The region of Cotopaxi in Ecuador experiences a notable number of earthquakes with an average of about 68 quakes per year based on data from the past 10 years and historical records dating back to 1900, and that shows the possible connection with the events in Chile. It's always shaky there. Well, there have been no recent significant earthquakes reported in Cotopaxi, Ecuador. It is important to know that the area is seismically active, and monitoring for potential seismic events is crucial for preparedness and response efforts. So most likely because of the volcano in Ecuador, like the whole area is like really, really like a risky, you know, and it's important to monitor the activities there. And also, like, let's go back to Europe for a sec. Like, let's not forget, like, the famous 1755 earthquake of Lisbon, which had such a profound effect on the world that we are still feeling its impact today. The BBC referred to it as the earthquake that changed history. However, in many respects, we bear responsibility for the earthquake's devastation. We are increasingly living in major metropolitan regions, and this tendency is expected to continue. Currently, more than half of the world's population lives in urban areas, with this proportion expected to rise to 68% by 2050. And, you know, the truth is, we also fail with the structures and material in order to make it cost-effective. Although I'm not an expert in material science, it appears that many earthquake casualties might have been prevented, right? And this shift towards urban living is driven by factors such as population growth and migration from rural to urban areas. The United Nations predicts that by 2050, an additional 2.5 billion people will reside in urban regions, and it's mostly going to be Asia and Africa. Notably, countries like India, China, and Nigeria are projected to contribute significantly to the growth of the world's urban population. And this trend indicate a transformation in how people live and interact, emphasizing the importance of sustainable urban development to address challenges related to housing, transportation, infrastructure, employment, and basic services for both urban and rural populations. Until recently, seismic networks were unable to reveal the precise consequences of an earthquake on various soils, sites, and buildings. Seismographs were too widely distributed to provide a high resolution view of ground shaking, and seismic networks excluded buildings. Researchers have now installed affordable accelerometers, which are tiny devices that measure acceleration and are typically used in cell phones to detect motion and orientation in buildings ranging from the ground floor to the top story. The Community Seismic Network collects data on how the earth and buildings move in order to improve construction safety and damage detection. But there is still hope, because technology, particularly AI, is improving, and is the number of sensors deployed in buildings. To avoid horrendous casualties, I believe it is preferable to employ lightweight materials and small-scale structures. I'm not suggesting we live in elderberry tree-made little boxes, but you get the picture. The biggest ever was, like, actually, there were a couple of big earthquakes, like Valdivia, Chile on May 22nd, 1960, with a magnitude of 9.5. Then Southern Alaska on March 28th, 1964, with a magnitude of 9.2. Then Indian Ocean on December 26th of 2004 with a magnitude of 9.1. And also the famous, or should I say notorious, Tohoku in Japan on March 11, 2011 with a magnitude of 9.1, which triggered the devastating tsunami and led to a significant nuclear accident at the Fukushima Daiichi reactors. And I will never forget that particular accident, because this was the time when I was training Aikido, and a couple of my buddies from the dojo, they booked tickets for Tokyo, like, I think like even month before the accident, right? So instead of going to Iwama Ryu, they had to cancel everything, like, so it was, you know, an interesting anecdote, right? So yeah, it was like the tsunami disabled the power supply and cooling systems of three Fukushima Daiichi reactors, which resulted in a significant nuclear accident where all three cores largely melted in the first 3 days. And the aftermath of this event included over 18,000 deaths, destruction of thousands of homes, and an estimated economic loss of $360 billion. So the disaster highlighted the importance of disaster preparedness and mitigation strategies in the face of such catastrophic events. And of course, I can't like escape this one. Like, it's the Loma Prieta earthquake, which struck California's central coast on October 17th, 1989 at 5:04 p.m. local time. The shock was centered in the forest of Nicene Mark State Park in Santa Cruz County, about 10 miles northeast of Santa Cruz, on a part of the San Andreas Fault system, and named after neighboring Loma Prieta Peak in the Santa Cruz Mountains. It was 6.9, and it caused 63 deaths and almost 4,000 injured. The Loma Prieta segment of the San Andreas Fault system had been relatively dormant since the 1906 San Francisco earthquake. Yeah, but let's look at the bright side of the event. Like, the thing is, it happened during the game of San Francisco Giants and Oakland Athletics, so today it's still known as the World Series earthquake, and the championship games of the year is known as the Earthquake Series. Well, my hometown of Zagreb has experienced multiple earthquakes throughout the history, such as in 1830, twice in September and October 1838. Other strong earthquakes were felt between Zagreb and Ljubljana in 1871 and 1878. And of course, the terrible one was the Skopje earthquake of July 26, 1963. That was destructive, like that was horrible. Like, the earthquake with the moment magnitude of 6.1 struck around 5:17 a.m. and caused terrible damage, killing more than 1,000 people, wounding like almost 4,000 people, and displacing over 200,000 people. So following this devastating tragedy, the United Nations coordinated a global assistance response to help the city recover and rebuild. International collaboration played a crucial role in developing a master plan for Skopje's reconstruction involving various organizations and architects to rebuild the city center and restore its urban fabric after the disaster. And my aunt, who was a medical doctor at the time, actually a pediatrician, flew there as a part of an emergency rescue team. I have a couple of buddies in Macedonia, and luckily their parents survived the catastrophe. The Balkan Peninsula is not as bad as the Ring of Fire or Nepal, but it's still shaky enough. Canada. Let's talk about Canada. Alison Bird, a well-known Canadian seismologist, works with the Geological Survey of Canada in British Columbia. Alison began her career by taking earthquake seismology courses out of curiosity, which eventually led to her pursuing a master's degree in the area. She is responsible for analyzing earthquake data, doing earthquake studies for the National Building Code of Canada, and communicating with the public through tours, presentations, and outreach initiatives. Alison's job entails estimating seismic threats, interpreting seismic data, and creating computer algorithms to interpret seismic information for public safety and preparedness. Despite the difficulties in planning for the aftermath of big earthquakes and overcoming public misconceptions regarding earthquake prediction, Alison is committed to promoting awareness among Canadians. So she's seismologist and liaison and outreach officer for earthquake early warning. She has been working as an earthquake seismologist with Natural Resources Canada since 2000, and for 20 years, she analyzed and researched Western Canada's earthquakes and even visited Haida Gwaii as part of a response team after the 2012 magnitude 7.8 earthquake. In recent years, Alison was a part of a team developing a comprehensive risk assessment for Canada. She routinely responds in the wake of significant events. Yeah, Canadian seismologists in general, they have contributed like a lot. Like they there is a lot of research on seismic like hazard assessment, then advancements in seismic imaging techniques, and like seismotectonic studies, like seismic zoning research. You know, they actually did a lot. And some Canadian seismologists specialize in seismic zoning, defining zones of seismicity based on geological data to assess earthquake risks and inform land use planning and infrastructure development. Well, if the famous Cascadia earthquake happens again, like something like that, which was in 1700, that was the most devastating earthquake in Canadian history. That would be a bad news. In 1700, it caused a disastrous tsunami that damaged coastal villages. And again, then the 1946 Vancouver Island earthquake, which was pretty bad, which resulted in damage and casualties in the impacted areas. It was on June 23rd at 10:15 a.m. It was 7.5 and it struck Vancouver Island. The major shock epicenter was located in the Forbidden Plateau area northwest of Kootenay, and the earthquake devastated Vancouver Island, destroying 75% of the chimneys in nearby communities such as Cumberland and Union Bay, as well as causing significant damage in Comox, Port Alberni, and Powell River. The earthquake was felt as far away as Portland, Oregon, and Prince Rupert, British Columbia. While Canada might not have as many earthquakes as some other regions, it still faces risks, especially in areas like British Columbia and the Great Lakes St. Lawrence River Zone. The frequency and intensity of earthquakes vary across the country, with regions like southwestern BC and southeastern Canada being more seismically active. Factors such as tectonic plate movement and geological constraints influence the occurrence of earthquakes in different parts of Canada. Also, in Canada, a fracking issue is a controversial subject. Fracking efforts in Canada, particularly in Fort St. John and Fox Creek, have been linked to generated earthquakes. These earthquakes are caused by the injection of fluid into the ground during hydraulic fracturing activities. The likelihood of fracking-induced earthquakes is influenced by local geology, seismic activity, and the amount of fracking performed over time. According to some studies, Major fracking-induced earthquakes have occurred in Western Canada, including Alberta and BC, with magnitudes ranging from 4.8 to 5.6. And now they're trying to make it all better. So in Canada, various alternatives to classic fracking technologies are being developed with the goal of making the process cleaner and more environmentally friendly, right? These options are, some of them are include like a waterless fracking, which involves utilizing natural gas instead of water to fracture rock in wells. And that also reduces the water usage associated with standard fracking procedures. Also, using recycled water and brine in fracking systems can conserve fresh water resources and reduce pollution from traditional fracking operations. Then there's wastewater purification. Implementing purification technologies can reduce contamination and reuse treated water in the hydraulic fracturing system. Then also reducing methane leaks. Technologies such as infrared cameras to detect leaks at fracking sites and replacing standard pressure monitoring pneumatic controllers with lower bleed designs that can drastically minimize methane leaks from fracking operations. Using alternative energy sources, replacing diesel-powered equipment with natural gas engines or solar panels can help to reduce hazardous emissions and environmental damage during drilling and pumping operations. I don't know, the whole thing with oil and gas business is complicated and it's political and it's, you know, follow the money, blah, blah. I would be ecstatic if Canada actually invests in fusion development instead, because that would solve problems forever. But what is actually causing like earthquakes? According to Caltech, Earth is made of a solid inner core, a molten outer core, the thick and mostly solid mantle, which occupies approximately 84% of the Earth's total volume. The thin crust is in between 5 to 50 kilometers in thickness, and the Earth's outer skin is not a continuous surface. Instead, it is composed of massive segments called tectonic plates. Earthquakes occur along the boundaries between tectonic plates or at the site of cracks within the plates, which are called faults. So what causes them? The tectonic plates that make up the Earth's crust are moving constantly, like, you know, they never stop. As the edges of these plates slide against each other in fault zones, friction can slow them down, leading to the buildup of pressure over long periods of time. When the force of movement finally overcomes the friction, sections of the crust suddenly break or become displaced, releasing the pent-up pressure in the form of seismic waves. And this is naturally occurring earthquake, sometimes referred to as tectonic earthquake. And by the way, Caltech has a phenomenal webpage. They have so much information there, you know, I'm really grateful that I found it. So while tectonic earthquakes can occur anywhere in the planet, the bulk of significant earthquakes, about 80%, occur in the Circumpacific Seismic Belt, which runs along the Pacific Rim. The Alpine Belt, which stretches from Eurasia's southern boundary through the Himalayan Mountains, Sumatra, in Java, and the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, which runs along the Atlantic Ocean's floor, are two more areas where earthquakes occur frequently. When an earthquake happens, several types of energy waves are produced, waves actually. The first detectable waves are known as P waves or primary waves. They're compression waves that push and pull as they pass through rock and liquid. The next waves to be recognized are called S waves or secondary waves. These waves only go through rock. They move up and down or sideways, perpendicular to the wave's direction of travel. Surface waves follow P and S waves. They travel along the Earth's surface, causing the most damage. They're also divided into two types: Love waves, which are faster and move the ground from side to side, and Rayleigh waves, which roll on the surface. It is currently impossible to forecast exactly when and where an earthquake will occur. let alone its magnitude. Seismologists, on the other hand, can use probability and predictions to predict where earthquakes are likely to occur. The most important earthquake measures are based on two distinct viewpoints, magnitude and intensity. So scientists define an earthquake as an event that occurs within the Earth. For the rest of us, it is a remarkable movement of the ground. Magnitude measures the former and intensity measures the latter. So in seismology, MW stands for moment magnitude, a numerical measure of an earthquake magnitude of or relative size. So Japanese seismologist Hiro Kanamori and American seismologist Thomas C. Hanks pioneered the concept of moment magnitude in the 1970s. It is regarded as the most accurate scale for determining the magnitudes of the largest and most damaging earthquakes, particularly those bigger than magnitude 8. Moment magnitude accounts for the earthquake's seismic moment, MO or M0, which is a measure of the overall energy produced by the earthquake. Moment magnitude, unlike the Richter scale, ML, body wave scale, MB, and surface wave scale, MS, accurately calculates earthquake size based on fault geometry and seismic movement. And when it comes to earthquakes, there's one thing I was always fascinated with it. Like, I didn't even know the name until I met this guy. He was a journalist at this TV station. And he was a scientific journalist. He explained me what piezoelectricity is. I was obsessed with it. So could it be that lights over the St. Lawrence River in Quebec are actually piezoelectricity? And is it behind the so-called cell combustion? That's a food for thought. Joke aside, according to the sources cited, there is no direct evidence relating piezoelectricity and spontaneous human combustion. Like, piezoelectricity is the accumulation of electric charge in some solid materials, including crystals, ceramics, and biological matter such as bone, DNA, and proteins, in response to mechanical stress. And French physicist Jacques-Pierre Curie discovered the phenomena in 1801. This effect is reversible, actually, which means that materials with this effect can generate mechanical strain when exposed to an electric field, and that's really interesting. The lights seen across the St. Lawrence River in Quebec are part of the two different phenomena, like earthquake lights and northern lights or aurora borealis, right? On November 12, 1988, a vivid purple-pink globe of light was observed near the St. Lawrence River in Quebec, preceding a strong quake, confirming the presence of earthquake lights, or that's actually piezoelectricity, from what I understood. Earthquake lights are unusual illumination phenomena that occur during or before earthquake activity and are created by the electrical characteristics of particular rocks interacting with gases in the Earth's magnetic field. Okay, so I'm not sure if I understood it well. Is it piezoelectricity or is it something else? See, that's one thing, that's my fault. Anyway, so earthquakes are largely caused by the movement of tectonic plates within the Earth's crust. When these plates, which form the Earth's outer skin, slide against one another in the fault zones, friction can accumulate over time due to their slow movement, resulting in a sudden release of tension along faults. This release of stress generates rapid motion along faults, resulting in seismic waves that cause the ground to tremble. But they can also be caused by human activities such as fracking, waste fluid disposal related with oil production, volcanic activity, mining operations, and subsurface explosions. These actions can produce seismic waves comparable to those caused by natural earthquakes. So what does the future look like? Can we expect something that we have never seen before? Something like terrible? Not 9 and not maybe 10, 11, I don't know. So is the future bright or should I say crusty? Can we ever expect a magnitude we have never witnessed before? According to the information that I supplied in the sources, earthquake prediction is still an immature discipline with no successful earthquake prediction based on fundamental physical principles. The so-called Gutenberg-Richter law of seismology states that the more little earthquakes occur throughout the time, the greater the risk of major earthquakes in the future, which is totally the opposite of what I heard when I was a kid. Like, I was always listening to my mom saying, like, you know, it's good to have little earthquakes, then there won't be the big one. Like, I say, yeah, whatever. However, anticipating a truly unique earthquake occurrence that outperforms all prior ones is fundamentally challenging due to the diversity of seismic activity and present prediction skills. While efforts are being made to enhance earthquake forecasting through approaches such as machine learning and deep learning, successfully predicting an earthquake that is wholly unexpected remains a serious scientific issue. The Mohorovicic discontinuity, sometimes known as the MOHO, is a prominent boundary within the Earth's lithosphere, separating the crust from the upper mantle. Andriy Mohorovicic, a Croatian seismologist, found this border in 1909 during an earthquake in Croatia. The MOHO is identified by a shift in seismic wave velocity from the crust to the top mantle of the lithospheric plate. The MOHO is significant for understanding the structure and evolution of the Earth since it contains information on plate tectonics and seismic activity. It can be detected using seismic data, which is produced by the release of energy during earthquakes and other disturbances. The depth of the MOHO varies by geographic region, averaging roughly 10 kilometers beneath the marine crust and reaching up to 70 kilometers beneath continental crust. Overall, the MOHO is a critical barrier in Earth's structure, influencing seismic wave propagation and providing important information about the composition and properties of the Earth's lithosphere. If you're still so intrigued by the earthquakes, I strongly recommend you to read Richter 10 by Arthur C. Clarke and Mike McKay. There are some conflicting reviews of the book, with some readers critiquing character development and language, but the Richter 10 is a fast-paced story full of dramatic events and scientific mystery. And my friends, that was all for today. The next time we'll discuss something about, I guess, solar eclipses. And I'm sorry, it's not only that I bit my tongue, but it's the spring is here, and my voice is not as it was is usually is. Stay seismological. Stay selective. Bye-bye.